Okay, folks, welcome to the latest chapter, the latest series of adventures from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, how are we this fine day?
Yeah, steaming, Mike. It's all hotting up, isn't it?
Well, when you say it's hotting up, I mean, we record in the early hours of the morning, obviously, not the early hours, sorry, very early in the morning when it's still quite cool and the breeze sort of wafts in from my roof garden and it's nice and gentle. I don't want it to get hot at lunchtime today. I've got to go out. I will have to put a suit on. That, to me, is a nightmare. Now, Miss Jones, since we last put words together on this podcast, Life on Planet Porky, you've been a bit of a star. On TV. I saw you over the weekend and I have to say how impressed I was at the way you delivered all the info and sold your latest book, The Stone Age. Yes.
Well, that's very kind of you, Michael. Yeah. This was on Mark Dolan's show on GB News,
yes.
On which you are no stranger.
Yes, well,
He's a very generous interviewer, isn't he?
Oh, he's a lovely guy, Mark. Lovely guy. I've known Mark for years, worked in radio together, okay. And not many people know that in addition to being a broadcaster on radio and TV, although mostly TV these days, he's also a stand-up comedian. And to me, the two hardest jobs in the world are being a stand-up comedian or a heavyweight boxer. A heavyweight boxer is all alone when he steps into that ring and he's facing Mike Tyson, and a stand-up comedian is all alone when he goes out onto that stage and he's got a baying crowd of fans. In fact, I think you've been to one of my one-man shows, haven't you, Miss Jones?
I did, and it was excellent. Well, Hens and Chickens, wasn't it?
The Hen and Chickens, that's right, yeah. Now, to be honest, I was trailing stuff there because I had plans doing more live shows, and that was a sort of trailer. And then, of course, the pandemic came along and all our plans were smashed to pieces, like a lot of other people's, you know. But I didn't think I was very good that night. I tried a few things, you know, which I thought would work, and some of them did, some of them didn't. But anyway, what I'm saying is, it is actually terrifying going out onto the stage, but Mark does it very well. I've seen him live at the Comedy Club, and as you quite rightly say, he's a first class interviewer, presenter, host of TV show. But generally speaking, I'm getting the message and the feedback that your book, The Stone Age, is actually making a lot of ripples in the literary world.
Well, it's nice to hear. Let's hope. It's early days yet. It hasn't even been out a month, but the reviews are fantastic and the feedback has been phenomenal. Mark, what I like about him as well, he reads the book. You know, he actually had a bookmark in his copy of the book, which was already a little bit battered because he's carrying it around with him. He's reading it. Not all interviewers delve into the book itself.
No, you're absolutely right. I've interviewed loads of authors, you know, including people like Frederick Forsyth and that. And I never had the time to read a book, so I just literally open it and then read a page or two and then have to refer to that. You know what I mean?
It's understandable because you're getting through so many guests, so many topics, subjects. You can't possibly have time to read it all. But Mark really impresses me because he actually is reading it.
Yeah.
Hasn't finished it yet, but he had a lot of interesting questions to ask. Mm. And he promotes you really well. Yeah. He projects you. He brings you in as part of the crew. I met the Crankies that night.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, how was that?
The Crankies were a real fixture of my childhood.
Yes.
Jeanette and Ian, isn't it? And they were so charming to me. They made a point of coming over and shaking my hand. Mm. And Ian Cranky said, "Oh, I'm going to get your book. I'm really excited to read it." And she was just a sweetheart.
Yeah.
And I think all these comparisons with Nicola Sturgeon are actually very unkind to Jeanette Cranky.
Yeah, I totally agree. The Private Eye calls Sturgeon "Wee Bernie," you know, but it is a play on the Crankies. You're absolutely right. But anyway, there you are. Now, I don't know if you've got plans to write another book, because I'm sure you have, Miss Jones, but I've got some very, very bad news for you. You may or may not have seen it in one of the Sunday supplements, but did you know that in future, a lot of books are going to be written by artificial intelligence?
Yeah, well, are they really? You know, I'm sure that it's a bit like that thing of give a monkey, however many monkeys, however exactly. many typewriters, yeah. and they will come out with the works of Shakespeare. Yeah. It comes to, in the end, the point at which a human has to intervene.
Yeah. Well, just briefly, it says here, it takes only seconds for the latest AI computers to write like Shakespeare, Austen, and even Jeremy Clarkson. So will robots make novelists redundant? So it's really about, you know, novelists and ideas, you know what I mean, and plots and twists and all that. But I'm sure if they get that sorted, next off, you'll have an artificial intelligence computer, and all you'd have to do was put in the words Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger, you know, Bill Wyman, Discuss, bang, and within half an hour you could have a book.
I suppose it would be an amalgamation of all the ideas about all those people that are out there already,
yes.
gathered, processed, and flung back at you in a not very exciting or original way.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm sure you're right. Now, talking about longevity of our careers, because a lot of my friends who are around about my age, about this time of life, you start thinking, what is going to become of me? Literally, you know, you're thinking, hang on, I'm now semi-retired. Now, I'll be perfectly blunt. I'm a very fortunate person in that I'm going to be able to look after myself, you know, for the next 10 years or whatever, and nobody knows what happens after that. Because I've had a successful career. I've been very, very lucky because not everybody has a successful career in which they can say that'll keep me going for another decade or something like that. So I'm not talking from a position here of fear myself. But a lot of my friends have said, I don't know what's going to become of me. I'm semi-retired. I'm sure soon I'm going to be laid off and don't see any prospect of an income. And the reason I'm bringing this up, Miss Jones, is because Mary Helvin, who is one of the most famous models of all time, one of the most beautiful women, gone out with some of the most famous men in the world. I think she was married to David Bailey, but she went out with Marlon Brando, Warren Beatty, Imran Khan, the cricketer and Pakistani president, has announced that she's so broke, she's going to try and get a job as a supermarket cashier because she has to, because she's got no way of funding herself. I mean, that hit me like a bang, a slap in the face. I thought, what? If I'd have gone out with you 20 or 30 years ago and I found out you were on your uppers and really, you know, desolate, I'd have gone and tried to help.
No, I think you're in the minority there, Mike. Most men would run a mile. And not even marriage is a protection from this kind of thing. I think she said she got a £100,000 settlement from David Bailey after they divorced. Mm-hmm. Well, as we all know, £100,000 doesn't go very far.
No.
Her profession hasn't helped because as a model, you have a very distinct sell-by date.
Right.
After which, once your looks start to disintegrate, the fashion and beauty worlds don't want aging women. That's a fact.
Well, sorry to interrupt there, but, you know, Michael Howard's wife, she's managed to become an aging model, hasn't she?
I thought she was an author.
No, Sarah Howard or something.
Sandra Howard.
Yeah,
she writes books.
Right.
And I think she's done a little bit of photographic work here and there on the back of her career as a novelist.
Right, I see, yeah.
But, you know, the beauty industry is not overflowing with aging women. Mm. You've just got to pick up any magazine and have a look. It's young faces that are staring back at us.
Yes.
They have, I think, brands like Dove, who make soap and shower gel and so on, and Boots. They have put a few older women into their advertising campaigns.
Yep.
But it's the exception rather than the norm.
Right.
So there isn't the work out there for someone like Marie.
Yeah.
She hasn't been looked after by the men in her life.
Yeah.
And she has run out of money, so she does have to do something.
Yeah.
I'm sure that in this country she'd be entitled to a pension.
Mm. Well,
but maybe she just wants to go home to Hawaii and live out her days in a simple way.
Yeah, she may never have paid national insurance in this country. Who knows, you know, because you come here, you're young, you don't get your finances sorted out. But I, as a male, I know this is very old-fashioned, I still feel I have some responsibility to try and help females who are in distress, okay? And she's clearly in distress. A few years ago, I helped out one of my friends. She was having some mental health issues and her job just disappeared. And she was one of the people who said, I don't know what's going to become of me. And I tried to help her as much as I could, supported her. You know, she needed treatment at the Priory and things like that. And then I'm afraid that her life just, you know, fell apart. But I know somebody else, because in our business you meet all these sort of people, who claimed, a lady who claimed to have had a relationship with Simon Cowell. And later her life turned and she turned to Simon Cowell for help. I don't know what the outcome of that was. I don't know. But I do think that, you know, these guys like Warren Beatty, if they know that Mary Helvin is, so surely it would just be kindness, wouldn't it? Just to contact her anonymously and say, I'm sorry to hear that, you know, here's $50,000 or something like that. I mean, I think that's a normal human reaction.
I'm afraid it doesn't happen. I mean, you've got Mick Jagger, for example, who walked away from Chrissy Shrimpton, his first serious girlfriend, who was the sister of Jean Shrimpton, the model, left her high and dry. Marianne Faithfull, he was involved with for years, walked away from her, left her high and dry. Mm. These women are not looked after. Keith Richards was much better at that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I was married for years to a guy who left me in exactly the same position with absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And I'd given him children. Mm. But he declared himself bankrupt rather than support me and the children.
Yeah.
And we came out of that with absolutely nothing.
So I'm
afraid that does prevail as an attitude among men. Yeah. I'm not responsible for her anymore. Why should I?
Yeah, well, I think that's so unkind. But, you know, maybe I'm the exception to the norm. Or maybe I'm a fool, because I have given a lot of money away in my life to people. You know, somebody came to me once and said, oh, look, you know, my oven cleaning business is, you know, going wrong, my van's broken down, all this kind of stuff. And they're a long-time friend. And I gave this person $6,000, but I never saw it again because, you know, the business just collapsed in the end. I mean, I don't know why I did it, but I just felt, you know, if I could help, then I should. But anyway.
I think the point there is that you have a clear conscience, you're a kind man, and you help people out. If somebody ever asks you to lend them money, you say, no, I don't lend money. Mm. I will give you the money and not expect it back if you're in a position to do that. Mm. Otherwise, you just have to say, look, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm not in any kind of position to lend or give money. But I mean, there is help in this country.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
For people who are on their uppers.
Oh, without shadow of a doubt. We've got one of the most sophisticated welfare systems in the world. In fact, many, me included, would say it's overgenerous. I still don't know how some people get away with it, because I go to one of my local pubs in Stockbroker Belt probably about twice a week, right? And it's usually after getting off the train coming back from something I'm doing in London, or getting out of a car that's brought me back from something on TV or something like that. And I go into this pub. Now, it's not always the same day. So it might be a Tuesday and a Friday 1 week, and then a Wednesday and a Saturday the next week. You know what I mean? But whenever I go in there, there are a group of people at the end of the bar who are, I mean, they live there. You know, it doesn't matter what time of day or night you go in there, they're there. You know, if it happens to be at midday or it happens to be at 7 o'clock in the evening, they're always there. And they are endlessly supplied with drinks across the bar. And they haven't got jobs. It's obvious they haven't got jobs, because they're never out of there. So unless they've done extremely well with some sort of inheritance or something, they live off welfare benefits.
Are they of a retirement age?
No, they're not. That's the point. And a couple of them were women. One of them, you know, is clearly has some form of disablement. I'm not sure what it is. She uses a stick or something like that. So obviously we have an obligation to help people who need help. But I just reflect sometimes how these people spend all day in the pub. And I'm not having a go. People say, oh, you know, attacking the working class and all that. I'm not, honestly. I just wonder sometimes whether our welfare system is too generous in this country. And, you know, I think incentive is a great thing. But anyway, we'll move on from that. Do you know Mr. Steve Wright? Is he a pal of yours?
I do know Steve Wright. I've been on his programme several times. I wouldn't say he was a friend exactly, but we are friendly. We know each other in the same circles. Mm. He's been very generous to me, promoting my books and so on. I was very upset to see that he was sacked from his afternoon show, but he hasn't had the boot, as people have been writing all over the place.
Yes.
Radio 2 have not dumped him. In fact, all over Facebook, people were reporting that he died. And there were RIP Steve Wrights all over the place.
Golly.
And I wrote on a couple of people's our pages. Actually, it's the show that's being cancelled. Mm. Steve is still alive. Yeah. He's still going to present Sunday Love Songs,
yes,
which is a great show on Sunday mornings. I'm usually driving into London right. on a Sunday morning, right. so I listen to that regularly. He's still going to be doing podcasts mm. for Radio 2. Yeah. And he says he will be there 2 days a week instead of 6 days
yeah,
a week.
Yeah, that is a big that's a big come down, though, believe me. When you've got a regular daily, I used to do a radio show, a breakfast show, 6 days a week. I did that for 4 or 5 years, getting up at 3:30 in the morning, 6 days a week. And I loved it. I was a lot younger, 20 years younger, actually. But I loved doing it. And suddenly when that amount of availability of airtime is taken away from it, it does hurt, believe me.
Yeah, but he's been doing it 24 years.
Yeah.
You know, that is a fantastic
image. Makes it even harder to give up, believe me.
I don't know. He's 67 and his health isn't great. Mm-hmm. Hasn't been great for quite a long time. And I think probably it's time for Steve to take a rest.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, that's an interesting perspective because the general feeling is that he's been badly treated, hasn't he? But look, I know from first-hand experience, so do you, every employer has the right to change the terms of the employment of the people they're employing. And, you know, just because the BBC is a national body funded by us, they still have to examine what they're doing. So, and I'm in the same business as Steve Wright, i.e. talking down a microphone into radio. So I can understand that he'll be very hurt by it, but it does happen in our business, doesn't it? An awful lot.
All the time. He's been incredibly gracious about yes. it. He was collared by reporters outside. I think it's Wogan House that he records from.
Yep. It's Wogan House, yeah. You're right.
Yeah, he was nabbed outside and he was really sweet and gracious about it, as he would be.
Yeah,
he's probably stung a bit. And people are very angry because it's a fixture. It's a national treasure.
It is. Remember when Jimmy Young went? I mean, there was nearly a national riot, you know?
Yeah, because people want things to stay the same yeah, always. Yeah. They like to have this backbone of Britishness that never yeah. is going to change. We're going to see the same thing when the Queen dies.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, God help us when Her Majesty finally goes, mm. because that is the backbone of our country. Mm. And these national treasures, we think we can't live without them, but we can.
Yeah, no, you're sure. I go into Wogan House quite a lot because that's where Jeremy Vine broadcasts his Radio 2 radio show, you know, as opposed to his TV show. And it's always fascinating because you get off the tube at Oxford Circus and then you walk down, I think it's Great Portland Street, okay? Then you turn left and you can tell Wogan House because there's always a gaggle of autograph hunters there, right? And the minute you turn the corner and go towards them, they all come towards you. And then, sadly, they realise, oh, it's only Mike Parry. So,
Oh, my God, it's the great Mike Parry. Yeah. Did I ever tell you the time I was working in Wogan House? I was doing what we call down the lines.
Right.
Before we had Zoom and Skype and all these things, yeah. if we were doing a bunch of radio interviews to promote a book, let's say, yeah. around the country,
yeah.
you go into a studio there and they plug you in to all the different stations around Britain mm-hmm. so that you haven't got to go hairing up the M1 to all these different places. So I was sitting in the waiting room between two interviews
yeah.
and in comes this woman, very flustered, and flops herself down mm. and she's wiping the sweat from her forehead and she said, of all the days to turn up here without any makeup on.
Yeah.
And I said, what are you doing? And she said, I'm recording a documentary about the writer of a show I was in for a really long time. Mm. And I looked up and sort of looked her in the face mm. and I realised that she was Cassandra from Only Fools and Horses.
Blimey, that's amazing.
And I looked at her and I started to cry.
Really?
For goodness knows why. And then because I was crying, she started crying because women set each other off in these situations.
What were you crying about?
Because Only Fools and Horses, it's making me cry now. Oh, it was such a great fixture of my growing up years.
Yeah.
I was devoted to that show.
Really?
I loved Del Boy, loved Rodney, yeah. all of them. And her being there just kind of brought it all back.
Was she was the girlfriend of Del Boy's brother, wasn't she? Rodney.
Yeah, Rodney, yeah. Right.
yeah.
Is it Gwyneth Strong, I think might be her name, in real life, Gwyneth Strong. She was absolutely lovely,
yeah.
but it was so funny because that show is held in such great awe and love.
Mm.
People around the country just... I mean, there are people who still watch it
yeah.
every day
yeah.
on various catch-up type shows that they can tune in. It was just such a funny, deeply emotional moment. Yeah, something triggered in me.
When you see somebody you've only ever seen on TV before, and you see them in, you know, in real life and real, in the real flesh. I did GMB, which is ITV breakfast show. I think it was last week or week before. And I was in the green room and a woman walked in and I thought, bloody hell. And I thought it was Dawn, what's her name? You know, who used to be married to Lenny Henry? Dawn.
Oh, Dawn French.
Dawn French, yeah. So, and you know, in those situations, it's not good form to go up and introduce yourself to somebody famous, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So I was thinking, I always think these days about how can I get the selfie, you know, should I do it sort of...
You're the last person I would have thought would say
that.
No, I
like to. So I thought maybe I could just turn away and do it over my shoulder. And I thought that's a bit sneaky, you know. Anyway, it's a good job I didn't, because it's got rather a tragic twist to it. The person who I thought was Dawn, what's her name again? Dawn
French.
Dawn French was in fact the mother of... Carolyn, you know, the poor lady who took her own life, Love Island hostess.
Oh, Caroline. I know who you mean. Yeah. Sadly, I can't think of her surname.
No, I can't at the moment. Caroline, not Flint, is it? No, Caroline. Anyway, apologies, but we know who we're talking about. And it was an anniversary of the death of that lady. So, you know, it would have been an horrendous situation had I, but I didn't do anything. And then later I saw the interview myself and I was full of nothing but admiration for the poor woman, you know, who's having to talk through the terror and the horror of, but it just shows you how careful you've got to be in these sort of situations.
Oh, was it Caroline Flack?
It was Caroline Flack. Well done. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, sometimes I have to reach into the recesses for these names, sometimes they come back.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I've got myself into a bit of trouble on Twitter.
Oh, no, not again.
Well, I didn't know until people started texting me and tweeting me and sending me WhatsApp saying you're trending on Twitter. And it was all down to the fact that we were talking about, you know, the latest Boris Johnson scandal about, you know, this guy, the deputy chief whip, going around groping people in the Carlton Club. And I'd simply said, look, you know, I don't think you can directly blame the Prime Minister for the drunken actions of one of his people when he's away abroad. And oh, blimey, did I get a volley full?
Yeah, I'm not surprised, but you have to get it in perspective, really. Yeah. There are some very vicious people on Twitter.
Oh, there are, yeah.
And they hide behind Twitter. Do you remember that Martin Brunt report on Sky News a few years ago where he turned up at a woman's house? She'd been hounding Madeleine McCann's parents.
Yeah.
And he went to confront her at her home and said, are you the person behind these vicious tweets?
Yes.
And she said, what if I am?
Yes.
And virtually slammed the door in his face. Mm. A few days later, the woman was found hanged in a budget hotel not far from her home. Martin Brunt was suspended.
Yeah.
And yes, she turned out to be this vicious Twitter troll.
Yes, she did, yeah.
But I think, you know, I had a look at the stats. 19.5 million people in this country have a Twitter account.
Yeah.
More than half of them are male, surprisingly.
Right.
The average time spent on Twitter is 4 minutes per day per person, which is not very much, is it?
No.
The most popular Twitter account is BBC Breaking News with 48.5 followers. The most popular celebrity, 48.5 million followers.
Yeah.
And the most popular celebrity account is Harry Styles. Mm. He has 37.3 million. So I think all of that in perspective, only 17 million people are using Twitter, which is not very much out of 62 million internet users in this country.
Yes.
I think you have to sort of think, well, yeah, it hurts, it stings a bit, but not everyone is seeing
it. No, it's completely out of proportion, because I read a figure somewhere say that 90% of tweets are generated by 1% of tweeters, because they're just fanatics. You know what I mean? They want to find somebody to hate. They want to find somebody to attack. They've got nothing better to do all day. They sit in their bedsit flats and write, you know, letters in green pen to people threatening them and all that kind of stuff. And that you know, there are those sort of people on in the world of Twitterati.
Yeah, there are. I think it's sometimes better to not engage.
Yeah.
Just don't engage with people who are abusive. Yeah. Just walk away from them. Yeah. People have said to me, well, it's very hard. Yeah. They say spiteful things and then I feel I have to defend myself. Yeah. No, you don't. Yeah. Just ignore them, block them.
Well, you're absolutely right. I used to engage with them and fire back and all that. And I thought, what's the point? And do you know what? If you look at how many followers these people have got, some of them have literally got 30 followers and they've just set the account up just so they can attack you. You see what I mean? So it's really not worth it. All I do now is if somebody sends me something which is even mildly offensive, I thought, I'm not engaging with you. I just block them. And then you can never hear from them again. And that's exactly what you should do. And you're quite right. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Myself, the Portmeister, and of course, Ms. Jones, who is very excited, Ms. Jones, about the prospects for your book. Why is it released at this time of the year? I thought the idea with the book is that you get it teed up, release it in October, and then you cash in on all the Christmas sales.
Yeah, there are two markets, really, the summer market and the Christmas market.
Right.
So they do tend to bring out a vast number of books just before the summer holidays. Mm-hmm. And also the end of October, ready for Christmas, as you say. But with the Rolling Stones, their 60th anniversary is fast approaching next Tuesday on the 12th of July. Yeah. So we're doing a big event in London that night at the 100 Club, Oxford Street.
Right.
We've got a great tribute band who are the Mick Jagger could be Mick Jagger. He's so incredible. And audibly, they sound like the band. Yeah. So we've got a band. I'm doing a live Q&A and people are going to go on a bus tour of Rolling Stones sites around London and then come back to the 100 Club. Yeah. Have the Q&A, they can buy books, I'll be there signing books and so on. And that will be celebrating the actual 60th anniversary.
Oh, well, that's excellent. Well done. I'm coming to see you at one of those launch nights. I think it's next week, the 13th.
Yeah, you're coming the day after to the Chiswick event.
That's right,
aren't you?
In London, yeah.
And then there are a couple more throughout the month. Okay. But the live events are really good because you actually get to interact with readers.
And that's brilliant.
It makes all the difference.
I worked with a Rolling Stones tribute band once called the Rolling Clones. And again, their Mick Jagger was just so brilliant, you know. Honestly, he had rubbery lips and he talked like Mick Jagger. And I actually made a record. I did a version of Paint It Black, which was made into a record and got to number 64 in the charts.
Amazing. Now, this band are called Rolling Stoned, they are phenomenal. I was talking to the lead singer, the Mick Jagger character, recently on an Australian TV interview.
Right.
And I said to him, why did you start doing this? And he said, look at my face.
Yeah.
How could I do anything else when you look like this? You know. I said, so were you a singer before you started impersonating Mick Jagger? And he said, no. I said, what, you've learned to sing on the job? And he said, well, he did.
Yeah. Well,
but I just would like to add, if anybody wants to come to the 100 Club, tickets are available on the 100 Club website.
Right.
The date is Ruby Tuesday, the 12th of July. Excellent. Next week.
Yeah.
Come on down.
And what do they do? Just go onto the website and...
go on the website and buy some tickets.
Brilliant. Well done. That's great. Now, talking about rock stars, I might put you on the spot here, Miss Jones, but I don't think so. Do you know a lady called Barbara Sharon?
Yeah, very well. Because, known her for years.
Oh, I've just seen a review of her book. I mean, she's writing the definitive, you know, sort of rock chick writer extraordinaire, except that she was like a PR lady in the world of rock and roll, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. She had formed her own agency. She came over from the States. She started out as a journalist. Then she was working at Warner Brothers when I first knew her. And she was one of the PRs who helped to break Madonna. And she wrote a sort of authorized biography of Keith Richards, which she went down to his house, Redlands, to write.
Right.
And obviously had a lot of input from him.
Yes.
She's really well respected in the industry. I read the extract of her book in the Saturday Times magazine, I think it was. And it's pretty good. You know, it's packed with stories that you won't hear anywhere else.
Yeah, well, that's I'm certainly going to try and get hold of a copy of it. But again, it's finding the time to read a whole book. Of course, I read your books, Miss Jones, because they're unmissable. But I haven't got time to read a lot of books. I think I've got about 60 books I've bought over the last 10 years, which I haven't yet read. And do you know what? I've always said these are for the day when I do actually decide to not talk again, not write again, not broadcast again. But I don't know if that day will ever come. I'll probably drop dead before it does. Now, sticking with pop stars, because there's a lot of stuff about. Do you see the stuff about Kenny Goss and George Michael? Kenny Goss has become a very bitter man, hasn't he?
I watched the Piers Morgan interview with him. Mm. You know, he runs the George Michael Art Foundation.
Yes.
And he's not short of money. He lives in a really lovely place.
Yeah.
He's talking because of these two new films that are out. David Austin, who is the executor of George Michael's estate. Yeah. He was friends with George when they were at school. He's created a film called Freedom. There's Simon Napier-Bell's new film, yeah. Portrait of an Artist, which I am in, apparently. Yeah. No, I've seen it. I know I'm in it.
Yeah.
And there's quite a lot of opposition to these films. Mm. Kenny Goss has held back a lot of what he knows about George. I've heard some stories about George Michael that would shock even the hardest bitten hack.
Right.
And there's a new book coming out by an American author, James Gaiman or Garman, I think he is, which I've read some of the early extracts. Yeah. It doesn't even touch the surface. I think that there is this need to maintain George as, you know, a troubled soul who was misunderstood, who hid his sexuality because of his family background, all this kind of thing. Yeah. But actually, the real story is much, much darker. Mm. And there is a drive to protect the public from what he really was, because then we will feel, just as some of us feel about Michael Jackson, that we can't honor and enjoy the music anymore because of the dark character who was behind creating it.
Yeah. Oh, right. So am I wrong in saying that Kenny Goss is a bitter man then? Is he in fact just keeping the name of George Michael alive in the best possible light?
Theirs was a love story.
Yeah.
Everybody talks about Anselmo Filippo, the young man who died of AIDS, who was involved with George. Yeah. And George himself even said at one point, he was the love of my life. Yeah. Actually, he wasn't. Yeah. The story you hear from Kenny is that theirs was much more of a love affair.
Right. Okay.
And Anselmo was passing through. He was a rent boy, to be honest.
Oh, dear.
And then you had Faddy, the guy who was sharing George's house right at the end.
Is he the one who wouldn't leave the house and have to throw him out?
But the real story belongs to Kenny Goss, and I think he will tell it.
Oh, right. OK, well, that's interesting. Now, Miss Jones, are you a Wimbledon fan? Are you keeping your eyes on Wimbledon day by day?
I sort of stick it on when I'm in the house, you know, but I don't record it. Yeah. I don't rush home to watch anything like that.
I love Wimbledon. You know, I love the occasion. I went there once and...
I only went once.
Yeah, I went to the... Well, I've been about half a dozen times, but I went once to the... I went to the women's final where the losing player put her head on the Duchess of Kent's shoulder and cried. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah. Who was that?
I don't know. I think she was from Czechoslovakia, though. But point of my story is that I went there with a lady who was married. And the lady who was married had told her husband she was going there with a group of friends, a group of girls, six of them, okay? And we were in the VIP area, so it all made sense, except that we had a seat in the third row, quite near the front.
Oh, no, you're spotted on television.
Yes, that's right. And there were no other women around. Certainly weren't six, you know what I mean? And so she had a bit of explaining to do later. It was a, what you might call a sort of uncomfortable moment, you know what I mean?
You were outed. I had an experience like that years ago. I went with my father to a boxing match.
Oh, yes.
And it was one of those early Frank Warren promotions.
Yeah.
There was a hotel in Russell Square where they started staging fights.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Just at a time when he was at odds with the rest of the boxing fraternity.
Yeah.
And he was breaking out and doing his own thing. Mm. And I was sitting ringside with my father at this fight, which was televised. Mm. And people obviously at home watched it. A couple of people phoned my mother the next day to say they'd seen Ken with another woman at this fight.
Right.
And it was his daughter. Mm. It was me.
Right. That's brilliant. When we were at school, I had a mate who was a very good golfer. And when he was about 14 or 15, he told me he was taking the day off to go and watch the British Open, which I think was being played somewhere in the northwest. I think it might have been Royal Liverpool or Royal Lytham St Annes. And lo and behold, the following week, Golf Monthly or Golf Weekly or something, there was a picture of him standing up the rope, you know, at the 18th green or something. And he, you know, was suspended from school for a week for telling the headmaster that he'd been ill and couldn't get to school that day. And on another photographic occasion, I got on the front of Time magazine. I was in Libya after the Americans had bombed the hell out of it. You know, it was when Reagan decided to attack Gaddafi. And on the morning after the first night of the attack, we all went out and I was standing on the edge of a crater that had been caused by an American bomb, a missile bomb fired from an aeroplane. And I couldn't believe it. The following week, I started getting all these messages. And lo and behold, I went into W.H. Smith, bought a copy of Time magazine, and there I was standing on the edge of the crater.
Oh, so outed by the cameras again, Mike?
Yeah, except that I was allowed to be there because I was working for the Daily Express and covering the story, so it wasn't really outed. But anyway, there we are. Just getting back to Wimbledon, I don't like this boy Kyrgios. I don't know if you know much about him, but he's a foul-mouthed Australian, goes around using the F-word, is alleged to have spat in the direction of a spectator who criticised him, and everybody said, oh, you know, he livened the place up. He's got lots of character, you know, best since McEnroe. The difference is McEnroe won it three times and his explosive personality was all part of the energy he needed to be the genius tennis player he was. Kyrgios, I don't think he's ever got further than the quarterfinals. I don't like people like that who sully what I regard as, you know, a beautiful game, tennis.
He's box office, isn't he, yeah, as they say. He's... I was a bit worried about him when he became a defender of Djokovic during that whole scandal down in Australia. Do you remember when, during the COVID period and so on? They call him the most talented player since Federer. I'm not sure.
No, neither am I.
Something I found out about him this week, and this surprised me, his mother is a Malayan princess.
Oh, really?
Apparently, she's from the Malaysian royal family. Yeah. She dropped her princess title when she moved to Australia in her 20s.
Golly. But still a princess nonetheless. The other thing about Wimbledon is I was very, very disappointed. A young English girl called Katie Boulter got through to the third round, okay? And this is after, you know, pin-up girl Emma Raducanu had gone out. Emma Raducanu went out in the second round. The other lady, Katie Boulter, gets through to the third round. And then, lo and behold, it's a Saturday scheduling. And I'm looking at the schedules for centre court, court number one. That's funny. Where's Katie Boulter gone? She was put onto court number two. And she went out 6-1, 6-1. And I'm pretty enraged about that because if it had been Emma Raducanu, she'd have been on centre court. And if they had done the decent thing and put Katie Boulter on centre court, I do believe that when you've got a home crowd on a packed centre court, it's got to lift you and got to give you an advantage over your opponent because you're playing at Wimbledon.
Yeah, she could have done with that projection. I do agree. I suppose she hasn't had the attention that Emma Raducanu has had. She did win the US Open at the age of 18. Yeah. You know, a lot of pressure was piled on Emma. Yeah. And people are now saying, oh, she's finished. She's washed up at 19 and so on. Yeah. She's 19. Yeah. She's only just starting. Mm. And it wasn't a fluke that she won the US Open.
No.
She won it, fair and square. Yeah. And she will be back for years and years and years. And hopefully so will Katie.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And by the way, Emma Raducanu handles it very, very well. She was said afterwards, oh, you must be very disappointed and it's all gone downhill. She said, are you joking? She said, I'm 19. I've already won the US Open. I do not feel under pressure. She said, of course, people want me to win again, but tennis players don't win every tournament they play in. Oh, she was very forthright, honestly. And also, she got so much stick. And I have to say, it was from lady columnists mostly, okay, in the newspapers. Oh, I know why she didn't win. She was weighed down by all that Tiffany jewellery she was wearing. Apparently, she was wearing £30,000 worth of Tiffany jewellery, who sponsor her, which, again, I think is a little bit bitchy. I see a lot of this from women columnists, you know, attacking another woman, and I find it a little bit distasteful.
So do I. We could name names, but let's not. Yeah. But they are very spiteful, very bitchy.
Yes.
And would any one of them turn down those sponsorships, those freebies.
Exactly.
I read a piece yesterday in the Daily Mail by a columnist we all know who was describing her latest, not exactly a facelift, but a procedure,
right,
which we know damn well was paid for by the newspaper, that she's getting all these facial treatments free. That is akin to a sponsorship. She's not turning those down. So why criticize a tennis player for a jeweler who is sponsoring her? I don't see the difference.
Yeah. No, I often wonder, you know, just how ruthless it has to be when you just attack other people in print. But there we are. Talking about women sportsmen, are you getting excited by the prospect of the Women's Euro Championships football, which are starting, I think, is it this week or next? I'm not sure.
Imminently.
Thank you very much indeed for getting me out of jail there, Miss Jones. Are you getting excited about it?
Yeah, really, really excited.
Really?
I do think men are staggeringly insecure about the fact that women football players are better than the men currently. Mm. They're saying things like women should stick to cooking and cleaning whatever.
No, I've never said
that. Fantasy ideal exists in these misogynists' minds about what women do. And then you've got these guys who watch football, talk about football, play it terribly one night a week or at weekends. Really, they're suffering because the women are doing better than the male team. I mean, come on, grow up.
Well, I've never really had a great interest in women's football, and there's nothing misogynistic about that. It's a different game to the men's game. It is a different game. It's got a big fan base. I think you'll find some sellout crowds, and I'm going to really try and get into it and try and appreciate it. I think the reason I've never gotten to it before is I've never really spent time in it. You know, I couldn't name the women's England football team, like I could name the men's. But I'm decided I'm going to watch these games, get into it and see if I can, you know, find a something to turn, like a light bulb moment, you know, turns on my head. Wow, this is great and all that kind of stuff. So I'm going to really give it a go and try and get stuck in. And of course, I'll be supporting the women, whether I'm watching it or not, because I want England to win. Turning, I'm afraid, Miss Jones, to far less savory and rather depressing news. Another shooting in Chicago on Independence Day. I mean, is it safe to even go to America anymore?
I don't want to go there. I used to love going to America.
Did I?
Yeah, I used to go there every week at one point, you know, covering stories when I was on Fleet Street. And I couldn't wait to get there. I was so thrilled the first time I went to New York, then moved across country and spent several years working on the West Coast. I'd made it in my head. You know, this was a dream for
Absolutely.
Me. You wouldn't get me within 10,000 miles now. Yeah. It feels like the least safe place on the planet, doesn't it?
It does. And it's a riven country. And what I mean is that since the era of Donald Trump, it is riven. It is cut in half. There are two incredibly opposing sets of people in America, and neither of them are the sort that I would want to go and party with. You know what I mean?
No, definitely. They're not going to do anything about the gun laws. Biden has done his bit to try and appeal to get things changed. Yeah. Nothing is changing. Mm. They are obsessed with guns in that country. They misunderstood the Constitution. They need to go back and read it again and actually get into the nuances of what that amendment meant. But, you know, meanwhile, they're hell-bent on protecting unborn fetuses, but they don't want to protect the little kids on their way to school or people just going about their business in a shopping mall or wherever. It's horrifying. Yeah. The rest of the world is looking on in horror, and I wish they could see themselves.
Mm. Well, yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying. You know, there's one lobby, you'll never give up the guns, the National Rifle Association. So they would be designated to the far right. But I was reading a piece about San Francisco just last week. San Francisco has become almost like a sort of massive, great homeless camp. You know, there's tents up and down the streets. The Bay Area, where I've been, you know, two or three times in my life, most beautiful location, you know, looking up at the Golden Gate Bridge and all that kind of stuff. It's now a shanty town. And the reason is because the politics of San Francisco is completely the opposite to the ones we've just been talking about. They believe in far left policies, and their very generous welfare benefits have attracted loads of homeless people from all over the United States. And now they've not only legalized cannabis, they're giving it away free. So it, according to the piece I wrote, it's just completely out of control. And a lot more cities are going to go like that because of the very odd idea that, you know, it's free love and all that kind of stuff.
It's spiraling into decline. And how do they change this?
It is. I don't know.
I mean, if they bring back Donald Trump, they're finished, aren't they?
Well, I don't know. I think if they don't bring back somebody who brings law and order and routine, the whole thing's going to collapse. I mean, look, all great empires eventually crumble and implode, don't they? The Roman Empire, you know? The British Empire, I suppose. And you kind of feel America might be at that point, particularly as China is waiting to take over as the most powerful country in the world, both financially and militarily. Talking about finances, Miss Jones, what would you think about getting yourself a 100-year mortgage and then handing that down to your children when your time comes?
Not sure about that, passing them down the family. What happens if you don't have any family or if the kids all fall out? Nobody can predict what's going to happen in the future. Yeah. So it sounds like a dodgy idea to me.
Yeah, well, I'm lucky. I got rid of all my mortgages about, I don't know, probably 10, 15 years ago. And I'm not boasting about that. You've got to remember that I took out a mortgage on my first house when I was 23. So usual mortgages in those days were 25 years. You know what I mean? So that's the way we used to do it. But I honestly, I don't know how anybody of sort of, you know, young working age, particularly in London, affords to buy anything these days because property is so completely out of control. Right.
I heard the housing market is going to collapse, though, isn't it, over the next year, 18
well,
months?
Well, I think the bubble's got to burst in some way. But with housing markets, you often get boom and bust, don't you? You know, I remember I had a house in the 90s, I think it was, for which I'd paid 132, but I had to sell it for 86, believe it or not, in a housing crash. It was a second property I had, so I wasn't homeless or anything. But I thought years later, crikey, that house is now worth about like 450,000, you know, but everybody's got a story like that about property. You know, you had to sell your house because of domestic circumstances. We all regret it, but I'm afraid it has happened to us all. Right. OK, folks, that's it for another week on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed, all of you, for listening. I think by the time we record the next one, I think by the time we record the next one, yes, I will have come and visited you at one of your book signings. So I'm looking forward to that very much, Miss Jones.
Yeah, can't wait to see you. It's been a while.
Yes, indeed. It certainly has. Great. OK, folks, thank you very much indeed. Back with you very soon. I go into Woven House quite a lot because that's where Jeremy Vine broadcasts his Radio 2 radio show, you know, as opposed to his TV show. And it's always fascinating because you get off the tube at Oxford Circus and then you walk down, I think it's Great Portland Street, okay? Then you turn left and you can tell Woven House because there's always a gaggle of autograph hunters there, right? And the minute you turn the corner and go towards them, they all come towards you. And then sadly, they realise, oh, it's only Mike Parry. Yeah. I went there with a lady who was married, and the lady who was married had told her husband she was going there with a group of friends, a group of girls, six of them, okay? And we were in the VIP area, so it all made sense. Except that we had a seat in the third row, quite near the front.
Oh, no, you're spotted on television.
Yes, that's right. And there were no other women around. Certainly weren't six, you know what I mean? And so she had a bit of explaining to do later. It was a, what you might call, a sort of uncomfortable moment, you know what I mean? Lo and behold, I went into WH Smith, bought a copy of Time magazine, and there I was standing on the edge of the crater.